Okay, we're gonna give it a go, and we're gonna start. I want to welcome everybody on behalf of Torah in Motion to our first online panel. We take pride in discussing the most important issues of the day in an honest and sophisticated manner. And of course, there's no more important issue than the unity of the Jewish people, and there's no more important issue than what's happening to thousands of converts. With the Yontif of Shavuot upcoming, the holiday of Gerut for all of Klal Yisrael, we're reminded that even Ruth, her conversion was not accepted by all, and it took a long time to have her conversion accepted, and David and Melech, etc. So in this mind, I'm sure everybody online knows about the crisis, the whatever word you want to use to describe what's going on, the Psak Halacha that was recently issued in Israel, and that's why we brought together our panel, you know, tonight, and we hope it'll work to the best of our technological ability. And I want to thank everybody, both our regulars who are here tonight and all the people who are trying E-Team for the first time, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And even if it doesn't work quite as well as you try, you'll come back again and you'll see how really amazing that our technology really is. The one change we've made for tonight from our regular E-Team classes is you will not be able to speak. You'll have to text message in anything you want at the bottom of the page, either by hitting to all if you want everybody to see, or if you only want a specific person like the moderator, one of the speakers, highlight their name and text it onto them. I just want to thank, you know, Shalom Eisenstadt, who without him we would not have E-Team. He was the brainchild of this, who saw it to fruition. He's working there in the background, and I want to thank him, and I want to thank our speakers, and thank all of you. And without further ado, hand it over to Dr. Elliot Malamud, my partner in Torah in Motion. Thank you, and I'll be quiet now.
Good evening, everyone. I want to, before I introduce to you our speakers, make a note that we're still waiting for Rabbi Farber to come online, and we're not sure if Rabbi Lau is going to make it because there are certain real difficulties he's having with his computer. So we apologize for that, and we'll see how we can do it as best we can. I just want to, before I introduce Rabbi Freundel and Rabbi Adlerstein, to lay out some of the context of the background of the situation, and then turn it over to them. Recently, there was a decision that was made in Israel in a Psak Halacha that is almost 50 pages long, that all conversions that are performed since 1999 by Rav Drukman's court are disqualified. And the trigger for this was actually a case in Ashdod where a woman came for a divorce hearing, and the Beit Din there in Ashdod checked out, began asking her questions about her conversion and her observance, and her answers obviously dissatisfied the ruling judge there, who ruled that, in fact, her conversion was not valid, and therefore she did not need a get. And this triggered off a larger kind of crisis, which culminated in the 50-page verdict by Rabbi Sherman and two other rabbis of the Supreme Rabbinical Court in Jerusalem, that led to the crisis that we now have. So we brought together, first of all, Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein, who is currently in Los Angeles. Rabbi Adlerstein holds the Irmas Adjunct Chair in Jewish Law and Ethics at the Loyola Law School, and he teaches Introduction to Jewish Law and Contemporary Issues. And he's the Director of Interfaith Services at the Simon Wiesenthal Center in L.A., and is a well-known author and blogger for many, many people. We have next to him Rabbi Dr. Barry Freundel, who's been the rabbi at Kesher Israel for many years in Washington. Rabbi Freundel has smicha from YU and his Ph.D. from Baltimore Hebrew University, and serves as an assistant professor of rabbinics at that school. And as well, he's the author of Contemporary Orthodox Judaism's Response to Modernity. And most importantly, I guess in this context, he is the head of the Conversion Committee for the Rabbinical Council of America. We are going to see if we can get the other two rabbis online, but we'll begin. And I want to ask Rabbi Adlerstein, beginning with you, you're familiar with the decision by Rabbi Sherman And we're not going to get into all the parameters of the decision, but it seems to me that Rabbi Sherman has certain core complaints, one of them being that Rabbi Druckman did not require, according to Rabbi Sherman, a lichatchila total acceptance of mitzvot prior to the gerut. And even more seriously, if one reads the psak, it says that Rabbi Druckman doesn't really qualify as a dayan because of this problem, and also because of a charge that he signed conversion documents when he was not present for the gerut, or even had others sign for him. In addition, Rabbi Sherman does not see that converting such individuals will be a benefit to the Jewish people because, in his view, they are not Jewish, and people will treat them as Jewish even when they are not. So those are some of the issues that were raised. Just briefly, I'm going to welcome Rabbi Seth Farber, who's come online with us. Rabbi Farber is also a graduate of YU and received his master's from the Rebbe School of Judaic Studies in 1995 and his doctorate from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in 2000. He's the founder of ETIM, the Jewish Life Information Center, which is an organization that aims to assist and educate secular Israelis about the various Jewish life cycles, be it marriage, divorce, conversion, and death, which are administered in the main by ultra-Orthodox rabbis in Israel, and tries to help facilitate that process and help them to understand it better. Welcome, Rabbi Farber. So we're going to turn it over to Rabbi Adlerstein. I'm wondering what your impressions are of the Psak Halacha and also how you would respond to some of the obviously quite angry responses to Rabbi Sherman's decision.
So I would take just slight issue with the background and the context that you gave, Elliot. I don't think that Rabbi Sherman invented the crisis. I'm really here as a member of a different Bet Din LeGiur, that is the Rabbinical Council of California, which actually, as Rabbi Frendel knows, serves an important role in the RCA putting together its current GPS, its Geirus procedures and standards. And I think some of us, especially here in America, know that this crisis has been brewing for years, if not decades. The issue is not just Rabbi Druckman's Beis Din, but rumors have been quietly percolating from beneath the surface for years, if not decades, that many rabbis, both in America and in Israel, were using standards that were not to the liking of others. And Rabbi Sherman did have specific halachic claims against Rabbi Druckman's Bet Din. Theoretically, his psak only related as an appeals court decision about one particular case in Ashdod. It's true that what he wrote has wide-ranging implications for he said, for tens and maybe hundreds of people, not the 15,000 that other people are bandying about. What I'm sort of neutral on this. I'm not representing the Rabbanut, and I'm certainly not representing Rabbi Sherman. I think we really should have had somebody here who could have taken Rabbi Sherman's side. I'm here as a member of a Beis Din who, after reading 39 pages of Rabbi Sherman's psak and then reading the entire Rehovot psak of 10 years, almost 10 years before, which is very, very similar, have abiding questions. And I do know that colleagues on all parts of the Orthodox landscape in the United States have those same questions. Just what are the standards of Batei Din, especially the Beit Din Miyuchad LeGiur in Israel, as well as scores of Batei Din in America? When you see people whose behavior after their conversion does not change in any manner or form from the way they were conducting their lifestyle before, you do raise certain questions about the Kabbalat mitzvot, the quality of the acceptance of the Ol of mitzvot, which virtually everyone in the Torah world believes is crucial in determining whether somebody is a ger or not. Personally, I'm aware of all of the political implications, but I don't think that they are half as serious as the implications for thousands of people, geirim, who are caught in the middle of all this until we get all of the halachic issues solved. And they are considerable. A bet din that's willing to accept geirim without real kabbalat mitzvot is acting improperly. And Rabbi Sherman has a point. I'm not convinced of his point, but he has a point that has to be answered halachically, and so far it hasn't, about whether a person who resists every important voice in the halachic community and sets a different standard, whether there might be an invalidation of his qualification to act as a dayan.
I'm wondering if, Rabbi Freundel, you would care to comment both on the original questions and also what Rabbi Augustine has been saying. I'm specifically interested in the notion that if they find out that there isn't full Kabbalat mitzvot, whether this can create a retroactive negating of the original Geirut.
I'm glad to comment. First of all, there are a number of facts that have been told to me that are different than the way you presented the background to this, and somewhat different even than what Rabbi Augustine said. I think it's important to understand that there's a question of substance and there's a question of procedure. The procedure is very important here. Some of the substantive questions that Rabbi Augustine raises are real questions that need to be investigated. But this began 5 or 6 months ago with the lower court decision in Ashdod. That was done in a very strange way, as follows. The conversation that led to questioning this woman in the process of the divorce was what we would call in America an ex parte communication. One of the dayanim, not all of the judges, had a conversation with her outside of the court and had some questions. That dayan then wrote himself a shaila, wrote himself a question about what was going on, went by himself without the Beis Din, sat in his own room and wrote a tshuva in which he, in effect, invalidated not only this particular geirus, said, in effect, that this woman did not need a get, which is a huge step, because the question then becomes, what happens if she were to then go to get a geirus that this guy would have accepted, and then, in effect, got married and had kids, but without a get? I mean, that's a very interesting question. And proceeded to take on all of Rav Druckmann's conversions in the same tshuva, concluding the tshuva, as I've been told, with the words Zechet Neged HaGeirut, and in the word Chet, which is a sin against geirus, in the Chet of the word Chet, he wrote Chaim Druckmann. So this was the way it was done. And he invalidated not just this woman and not just her kids, as one of the people scrawling on the bottom said. He invalidated the husband of this woman, the one she was getting divorced from, who's a native-born Jewish Israeli. This is the first sort of thing in this. Then it gets to the high court, and Rabbi Augustine, I think, describes quite correctly what's in the tshuva. But the question about a public tshuva like this is that without investigation, impacting on so many people in that way, I think that's a huge problem. Yes, we know that there have been people who've done conversions that were inappropriate. It's one of the reasons we set up the GPS was to try to standardize things. Rabbi Augustine's correct. We were one of the created Bat Din is the Rabbinical Council of California. They've been very important in this process. And the idea is to try to get a sort of set of uniform standards with some flexibility for difficult cases. But it's true, you have this kind of problem. But when you go ahead and take on a situation where you're going to say somebody's no good or some conversions are good, you have to do this very carefully. You have to do it case by case. You have to be very careful in the way that you publicize this, because the devastating impact on thousands of people to hear this kind of thing hitting the media, hitting the airwaves, coming out in this way, I think is really a problem. In fact, the RCA's response was not to say we accept all of Rav Druckmann's conversions, we don't accept all of Rav Druckmann's conversions. That's not the issue. The issue is much more, if you have a situation like this, what you do, how you function, and how you respond. Case-by-case investigation is one thing. Wholesale kind of attack like this, I think, is a problem. And so that's at least as a first cut is my approach to this.
Rabbi Farber, picking up on the notion of how does one respond, you're intimately involved with the lives of many of these gerim, and it must be quite chaotic and quite frantic now. I'm wondering, A, how they're feeling, what's going on for them, and B, what you see as the way forward here. going to try that again. I'm not
sure.
I'm
hoping you can hear me. I feel like Christian Amanpour in Baghdad. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead. Do you hear me?
Okay. Let me make two comments, or two initial comments. The first one relating to the particular case and addressing the notion that Rabbi Adlerstein and Rabbi Freundel raised. Essentially, the rabbinical court decision, both of Rabbi Ataya and Ashdod, if I may correct you, and in Rabbi Sherman's subsequent psak, did not fundamentally raise the issue of annulling conversions based on the standards of Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, or accepting the yoke of commandments. Instead, what it essentially did was invalidate the rabbis who performed the conversion based on their status as, in the words of Rabbi Sherman, Rishaim, or evil people. Essentially, they have the status of people who are unable to convert. That's a pure judgment call that has very little to do, at least at first blush, with the Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot. And if today they invalidate Rabbi Druckmann, then tomorrow I don't see any reason why someone couldn't come along and invalidate, I don't know, let's say someone who has a law degree or a university degree, based on the fact that there's explicit tshuva, you're not allowed to engage in those activities either. Perhaps someone who went to university is a rasha, and thus he can't perform giurim. The more basic issue, though, is what this has done to literally thousands of converts, and here allow me to say both in Israel and in the diaspora, who have literally been keeping our phones ringing off the hook at Itim. People feel the chaos, and they feel the sense of vulnerability that they haven't, that many of them haven't felt since they received their conversion certificate, both from the U.S. and from Israel. Rabbi Adlerstein, unfortunately, I think you're right. This is an old problem, but it's an old problem that we simply haven't kept in check, at least not in to a sufficient enough or a meaningful enough manner, in my estimation. I don't know how we, as committed Orthodox Jews, can allow the most vulnerable population in our community, that is the community of Gerim, to simply live their lives feeling vulnerable. I wonder, I question, I turn to the audience and I say, what does it mean to have your Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, your acceptance of the commandments, held in check? Is it a week, a month, a year, your entire life? Perhaps it's your children. If you haven't been able to demonstrate that your children were Shomer Mitzvot for the long term, then perhaps your conversion is invalid. In fact, such tshuvot do exist. Rabbi Axelrod, upon whom Rabbi Sherman based a significant amount of his psak din, does in fact believe that every year we need to invite a ger into our offices of converting rabbis and force them to demonstrate that they are still committed to mitzvot. Alternatively, the American Orthodox rabbinate from Rav Moshe Feinstein onward has pretty much adopted a distinction between Kabbalat Ol Mitzvot, that is, the acceptance of mitzvot in a sincere and genuine manner, and shmirat mitzvot. And the observance of commandments down the road. To the extent that one person adopts and accepts upon himself mitzvot for the long term, then we simply haven't, in the last 50 years at least, questioned the person's sincerity post facto. And now I think that distinction is coming into question, and I think that's a significant problem. Let me make it clear. I speak on behalf of hundreds or thousands of Gerim at this point, most of whom are Shomer Mitzvot, and I believe they should be Shomer Mitzvot. But I also recognize the realities of both the contemporary Jewry in diaspora and in Israel, and I recognize that that has to be our goal, and not necessarily our means.
I'm just going to call on Rabbi Kelman to ask a question about the Langer case.
Thank you. I'll ask you, Rabbi Adlerstein, what I have found absolutely baffling, and no one's able to explain, Rav Gorin became a persona non grata, and Rav Elyashiv left the Rabbanut in the 70s because Rav Gorin invalidated the Langer conversion case, in order to save a mamzer, someone who could not, you know, finish the Shema Yisrael. And basically, the same people now who say that they want to invalidate the Geirut went absolutely ballistic and saying there's no way we can invalidate a conversion. Langer is for sure Jewish, etc., etc. And it's really only because of that that Rav Al-Yashi became the gadol that he is today, because he left the Rabbanut. So I just don't understand the blatant contradiction, really, between the two cases. If you could possibly explain how they would deal with that issue.
My pleasure. Not only don't I see a contradiction, I think that they coincide perfectly. I think that the answer to both your question and to one of Rabbi Farber's point is that we're dealing with halachic entities and not with people shooting at the hip. If you don't mind, I turn first to Rabbi Farber. Any fears of people being invalidated as Rasha because they have a university degree or because they wrote a blurb for Natan Slifkin's books are greatly exaggerated. Rabbi Sherman was using a halachic category. It's found in Shulchan Aruch, it's in Siman Lamed Aleph, in Toshim Mishpat, that a person who violates any Isur in the Torah becomes invalidated as an aid, and elsewhere we learn as a Dayan. Rabbi Sherman's argument, in fact, was that Rabbi Druckman and Rav Avior were violating an Isur of Lifnei Iver Lo Siten Uchshal, as held by a whole slew of contemporary poskim, including Rav Kook, including the Achiezer, the Dvar Avram, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orvach. It was on that basis that he called him Rasha. It was not an estimation of the quality of him as a person, but strictly halachic category. Similarly, in the Langer case, I think that the methods that were used, even though they do seem ironically to have flipped, they're really the same thing. Both in both cases, the Haredi camp maintained, in fact, that if there was no Kabbalat mitzvot at the beginning, then the Geirut was null ab initio. How to determine that? Well, Rav Zaychovsky of the Rabbinic Appeals Court maintains that there's no way of doing it. But most poskim hold that if you see no change in the behavior of the Ger from before Geirut to after, you can in fact assume that there was a problem with Kabbalat mitzvot at the time of the conversion. In the Langer case, the issue was brought up well after Berakovsky, the person involved, had established himself as a member of the community and insisted that he in fact was a partially halachically abiding Jew, had made a transition from before the Geirut to afterwards. And now it's a question of whether you have sufficient evidence to undo that. In the case of Rav Atiyah in Ashdod and the case 9 years before in Rehovot, the principals themselves completely conceded what their level of observance was at the time of their Geirut and how they adjusted to their Geirut afterwards. The issue here is simply a question. I shouldn't say simply, nothing is simple. But the difference is in the level of evidence that you need and that can be satisfied halachically. The opposition in the Langer case was that Rav Garin Zichrono Livracha had accepted evidence that conflicted with the norms of halacha. In this case, the Geirin involved freely admitted, as did their spouses, to whatever level of observance there was. I'm not passing judgment about whether that level of observance should be enough to invalidate it. In Rabbi Sherman's eyes, it was. But the facts were not disputed. The question only was that sufficient to create what we call an anan sadeh, a presumption that there was not a full Kabbalat mitzvot at the time of their immersion.
I wanted to step in here and just ask about the social ramifications of this. We've been arguing and somewhat technical terms about the Psak Din, all of us are aware of the fact that there are very large social issues involved here in terms of hundreds of thousands of Russian Jews in Israel and the potential fallout and chaotic fallout of this decision and what it might mean for people in Israel. I'm wondering how we can balance off the needs of, say, the halakha in terms of acceptance of mitzvot, in other words, conversions the way we'd love them to be, with the actual facts, the kind of social facts, of great difficulties with a great influx of people who are coming to Israel and what we do with those people. I'm wondering how can we balance off those different needs. I'm going to address this to Rabbi Forndel first.
Very good question, and to go back to what I said, part of the conversation here, part of the conversation that I've seen that troubles me is, yes, obviously you have to apply the halakhic categories and all the halakhic precedents. But you're dealing with human beings, and you're dealing with individual human beings, and you're dealing with individual cases, and that's what makes this very difficult. When you do these kind of blanket kind of statements, and nullifying an entire Bezdin, nullifying a Dayan who's done all of these things, and you do it wholesale, you're not reflecting the concern that you're saying here, and what you are doing is setting out a tone that says to, as Rabbi Farber says, lots and lots of people, and I can tell you, sitting in a shul with a lot of gerim, they are suffering huge amounts of pain over the fact that at any point, at any time, they could be declared null and void. Look, we had this happen in America. 2 years ago, we were told by the rabbinate in Israel that essentially the conversions in America coming from the RCA were not acceptable anymore. And thank God we managed to put together a deal that is holding, it's working without sacrificing our integrity. But I have to tell you, those weeks and months before it was put together were terrible time, and the people who were affected are still afraid of this. So in terms of your social implications of this, yes, you have all of these Russians. You have others who have come. Does that allow a Beis Din to take certain leniencies, to take certain positions? And when I say leniencies, I mean there are positions in halakha. There's Rav Uziel's position. There are other people's positions that are out there that in times of a Shas HaTchak, you might be able to do certain kinds of things. Not necessarily optimal. But again, I think that has to be looked at carefully. I think it has to be looked at quietly. And I think for the sake of not afflicting the ger, the fact of the matter is you do need to have an individual kind of process that allows for both halachic integrity, but the leeway to understand that there might be a Shas HaTchak or B'dieved or all those kind of things. We've done away with all those kind of things. And with respect to Rabbi Adlerstein, I hope you're right that they don't go after people with college degrees and such. But there was a conference on Gayrus in my neighborhood where one of the speakers stood up and said that anybody who wears a brown shirt, I didn't wear a brown one tonight, I wore a blue one, maybe that one's okay, I don't know, but a brown shirt can't be a Dayan, and anybody who believes that the world is more than 5,768 years old, even if you believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was part of the guiding force behind the evolutionary process, couldn't be a Dayan. You know, those kind of and they were said in the name of Rav Yashiv. Those kind of things are concerning because there are people who are trying to do this, and there are people who are trying to delegitimize. And I made this point before, at least in terms of my own reading, when the Maimonidean controversies happened, when there were the Cheirim, from Spain against Franco Germany and Franco Germany against Spain, when the Rambam's books were either burnt or pages were burnt or threatened to be burnt, I have no sense that anybody in Franco Germany ever declared the Rambam's conversions to be no good, or vice versa. Those are the soft underbelly, and you do this kind of great discretion instead of wholesale. And even where, I know the RCA and the Bezdin of America, we have certain people who have done conversions that we don't like. It doesn't mean that wholesale those conversions are declared no good. Case by case, individual by individual, quietly, people will look at. That's where the social implications come in. And suddenly making this whole big public kind of thing, where suddenly we're taking hundreds of people, putting them at risk, many of them very sincere people, many of them today, forget when they converted, they've been converted from that, the day they converted until today, it could be 10 years later, 15 years later, but without simply looking at the cases, saying, in effect, oh, this guy is no good, this business is no good, everything they ever did was no good. I think that's really where the problem in the social side is.
I wanted to ask Rabbi Farber just a simple question about the actual process of this. Where do you think this is all going? Because right now, there seems to be a kind of limbo going on. It's unclear whether the psak of Rabbi Sherman is the one that's holding or those people who oppose it is holding, and it puts everything in a kind of a limbo situation. I'm also wondering if you can comment on the role of Rav Amar in all this, which seems somewhat murky to me.
to a large extent, there is chaos on the street here when it comes to conversion. First of all, on the technical level, the notion of recognizing conversion really plays itself out in one particular legal sphere in Israel, and that is the legal sphere of marriage. People who convert here through the conversion authority generally are those who are seeking to get married, and if local rabbinates refuse to recognize, as a number of them do, refuse to recognize the legitimacy of the conversion done through the conversion authority, then those people effectively have no recourse for getting married. We've launched a campaign to try to encourage Rabbi Amar to make a definitive statement on the issue. I spent more than 8 hours in the Knesset over the last 2 weeks with representatives of Rav Amar, representatives of the law committee in the Knesset, trying to come up with some modus operandi that would allow people who converted through the conversion authority and through the state conversion system to be able to marry in Israel in a halachic manner. It should be made clear that the weekend that we published an ad trying to defend Rabbi Amar and encourage, or the conversion authority in an attempt to encourage Rabbi Amar to defend the certificates that he himself has signed, Yateid Ne'eman published an anti-ad that basically encouraged Rabbi Amar to distance himself from Rabbi Druckmann and come on board with Rabbi Sherman's psak. So essentially what I'm telling you is the reason, the character of the chaos is based on the fact that the rabbinate is here is essentially political, and as such is subject to various interests. If the Jewish world were to scream out on behalf of those who I believe are exceptionally vulnerable, then I think that Rabbi Amar would step up to the plate and defend converts and thus essentially distance himself from Rabbi Sherman's psak. Right now, he spent the last 2 weeks kind of measuring his moves very carefully. To be no legal authority in terms of convincing marriage registrars to do what they want. Last week in the Knesset, Rabbi Simcha Cook of Rehovot gave a long discourse on why he sees the need in Rehovot, at least, to evaluate each conversion on its own terms following the issuance of a conversion certificate from the conversion authority. So essentially chaos reigns here. Rabbi Amar does have the moral authority, I think, to essentially distance himself from Rabbi Sherman's psak. In terms of where it's going in three directions. One is in the Knesset. There are at least two bills on the table right now in the Knesset to essentially perform an end run on Rabbi Sherman's psak. So it could be this will be decided not in rabbinical courts at all, but in the civil legal authority. Just a number of hours ago, around midnight here, I received a copy of a Supreme Court brief that's going to be filed in the Supreme Court in the coming days that is essentially suing the rabbinical courts for operating outside of their jurisdiction. So it might not be resolved through law, it might be or through legal, you know, through the passing of laws, it might be resolved through a Supreme Court case. And at the same time, Rabbi Amar has made a commitment, which yet so far unfortunately hasn't been followed through, that he will put together a new bench of rabbinical court judges that will evaluate the significance of Rabbi Sherman's decision, and at least according to the promises that have been made in the back corridors, will evaluate it in a way that will essentially neutralize it from affecting other gerim. But right now, as we go into the holiday of Shavuot, I have to say, I'm not the only person who's not sleeping at night because of this conversion issue.
May I respond?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on something that he was saying and actually throw it over to you, Rabbi Eberstein. He talked about the process being political, which is a highly charged word to use. And since Rabbi Lau had difficulties technically that couldn't allow him to be here, I'm going to quote him. In his name, he writes, "The Israeli political system is holding all the Jewish citizens of this country hostage. to the religious institutions controlled by the Lithuanian ultra-Orthodox, which is doing everything in its power to keep the light of Torah away from Israeli Jews. And obviously, those are very highly charged words. And what they do is that they frame this dispute not as many of the disputes of Jewish history, which are, you know, intense and even severe halachic disputes between people of good intent, and there's vigorous argumentation. It takes it out of that framework into a framework where it loses that purity and becomes a kind of corrupt political dispute with ulterior ends and so forth. So I'm wondering, since the word political has been used here, whether you feel that's what we're actually dealing with here. I mean, let's call it what it is. Are we dealing with an attempt basically to wrest control from religious Zionists and to, in other words, in the gay roots domain? Or is it simply another in a series of halachic disputes throughout Jewish history?
I'm glad we got to what I think is the elephant in the room. Ironically, without Rabbi Sherman being here, I think that he could easily employ the same words as Rabbi Lau in the other direction. I think since the establishment of the state, certainly since the Seidman case and the Langer case, part of the halachic community felt the polar opposite, that there was an attempt by the Dati Lumi community to wrest control of halachic process and to make it subservient to political interests or to the interests of the state. Personally, I believe that was also l'shem shemayim, if it was true at all, that there are many people in the state of Israel, and some not in the state of Israel, who believe that Torah must have the ability of addressing modern problems. But it can't come at the expense of a violating halachic procedure. I'm sort of overwhelmed by the fact that Rabbi Farber takes comfort in the fact that by a ruling of the Supreme Court or some other wing of the state, the issue may get settled. Since when, except in Napoleon's Sanhedrin, did a secular state, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish, it shouldn't make any difference, arrogate to itself the right to trump halacha? If there are halachic issues, those halachic issues have to be dealt with as halachic issues. The elephant in the room is that the problem was not created by Rabbi Sherman. I don't want to point a finger, but I'm sure Rabbi Freundel will attest to being in the same position as I've been many times, with people outside of the Orthodox community saying, can't you Orthodox guys get it straight? You guys are dividing the Jewish community with your insistence on these and these trivial little details. You are breaking the unity of the Jewish people with your insistence on standards of conversion, of matrilineal descent, of having kosher food at community events. Why can't you guys stop the splitting apart of families and the like? And our response is complex, but I think an elegant way of putting it is a story about an elderly couple sitting in front of their 1950s vintage car, and the husband's, you know, driving behind the wheel, and his wife turns to him and says, George, why can't things be like they were in the old days, 50 years ago? Don't you remember when we were young and dating? We could hardly get enough of each other. We used to snuggle next to each other in the front seat of this car. Now look at us. And George turns to his wife, who's sitting at the other end of the bench seat, and says, I don't know about you, dear, but I'm still in the same position I was 50 years ago. There were standards of Kabbalat mitzvot. There are standards of halachic process that determine which dayot are acceptable and which are not. Rabbi Freundel said perhaps Rav Uziel's tshuva could be used b'shat hadchak. I think that's fair. You must understand, though, when you try to take a kula, a minority opinion, and then effectively foist it on the rest of the community and tell them that these people will be considered Jewish, they will be accepted as Jewish if they apply for a job as a mashgiach in a restaurant. You must accept them as Jews when they come to sign a tshuvah at a wedding 3 months from now, or a generation from now. You've created the problem, not Rabbi Sherman. The attempt to institutionalize, by force of the state, the acceptance of minority opinions unacceptable to what we would call rov minyan and rov binyan of halachis around the world was and is a fatal error. I don't have an easy fix for that.
Rabbi Freundel, would you care to comment?
I actually would care to comment on it. You're right, Rabbi Adelstein, it's a very complex question, and I'm not as sure as you are that there isn't leeway to say that when you have a Beis Din, that it's a massive Beis Din, it's an act on the part of the Beis Din, if they did it legitimately, if they did it with, you know, legitimate COVID rush, that other Batei Din should accept it. I mean, it's an interesting thing. The Mishnah talks about Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, how even though they differentiated in many ways in Gittin and Kiddushin and all the rest, still they didn't invalidate. They may not have necessarily married, which is the Gemara, you know, that follows up on, that they, you know, kept away from people who were questionable, but they didn't do the invalidating thing, even though, in many cases, a get according to Beis Hillel was not a get according to Beis Shammai, and therefore if the woman married again, it would be Mamzerus and all the rest of it. They didn't go to this level, and that's where my concern is. I have less of a concern if people want to look, as I said over and over again, case by case, issue by issue. But you also, when you do that, have to recognize what might be a legitimate act of the Beis Din. You also have to recognize that Shat HaTzchak is a legitimate kind of area of halakha. And you have to recognize that when you start to develop a state and try to put halakha in place, do it the other way. Yes, you're right. Politics should not control. A vote of the Knesset should not determine who is a Jew. All of those kind of things, I absolutely agree with you. But on the other hand, when you're putting halakha into statecraft and you're trying to bring halakha into a Jewish state, there are certain places where the Baal Halakha has to recognize the circumstance, and other people, even if they might make a decision about an individual and say, well, this isn't comfortable for me, can't go to the point of saying the whole thing's invalid, the whole thing's no good, unless you can really show that this was done with venality and absolutely, you know, no seriousness at all. And that's certainly not the reports that I have. At least the things that we've been investigating and what I've heard is that most, you know, by far, the vast majority of Rav Driftman conversions were probably okay. And I'm not going to swear to that, and I haven't investigated them personally, but at least that's what's coming at us. That's where I think we differ. There is a certain COVID rush about invalidating and how far you go and what you do. And I use the Beis Hillel Shammai model because I think it's a very good one.
I agree that the model is perfect, and Beis Hillel did, in fact, invalidate women of Beit Shammai and their progeny as being manzer. The courtesy that they extended to each other was allowing each party to live within the parameters of their own halachic community, and that's not what's happening here. I also have to take slight issue in that there are some minority opinions which cease to be halachically effective. If you won't agree with that, I'm going to request your wife's cell phone number so that I can call her after the show and tell her that you're flirting with the idea of taking a pilegesh on the basis of Rav Yaakov Emden's tshuva, Simon Tezvav, that permits people to take a pilegesh today. Now, Rav Yaakov Emden was perhaps the Gadol Hadorah, close in his generation, yet that minority opinion simply has no effect at all. Kvodo b'makom ha'munach, but Rav Uziel's tshuva, which he himself had difficulty with and wrote different tshuvas saying that a Kabbalat mitzvot that is pro forma and has nothing behind it is of no consequence. I believe everyone that I know of in the halachic community, on all sides of any divide that you want to create, serious balei halacha do not see any peer, with possibly the exception of one tshuva of Rav Unterman, and he had qualifications as well. And that really is what's behind this. There is less than what should be available to create even a geirut b'dieved in a small number of cases. Rabbi Sherman claims that they were in the tens or perhaps hundreds, not the thousands. But the sad fact is that when all of this gets out of the bag, and it has in the United States, even without this issue, the buzz in the street is that for decades there were Batei Din that were not acting properly. And once they're rumored not to act properly, anybody who came from that Bet Din, they could become Rashi Yeshiva by now. It won't make any difference. They, I agree with Rabbi Farber, are going through Gehenom. And I don't see the end in sight. The Bet Din that I'm on gets calls every week from people who want to know, should we do another Tfilah L'Chumrah? We're reluctant to do that at the expense of the first Bet Din. What kind of a statement is that making for them? But they're people now who have to marry off their children or their grandchildren and are looking back at Dayanim who were known to have standards unacceptable to the rest of the community. Even if Rabbi Sherman's decision in the end will be rejected, what is out there in the streets is a Chazon Ish on a Mechaber in Siman Yud Aleph, I believe, in Choshen Mishpat, that speaks of the qualifications that a Dayan must have. As you know, in Parshat Yitro, there are 7 qualifications that a person has to have besides knowing the law. Different ways of showing sterling character. The Chazon Ish says that doesn't mean that you need the Gadol Hador or a Tzadik Gomor. It does mean, though, that if a Dayan has a reputation for being below average, different from the current standard, in any one of those areas, he is, in fact, pasul to be a Dayan. There's enough buzz out there about scores of people that Geirim, their children, and their grandchildren are now concerned with this. And the problem was not created by those children or grandchildren. It was by the people who decided that they were going to use standards that ran afoul of the community, not tell those people who they were converting, and leave the consequences for future generations, just as non-Orthodox rabbis commonly will convert people and tell them that their conversion is every bit as good as an Orthodox conversion. It's only a matter of politics. And leave those people in the lurch a generation later when they find out that halachically they're not Jewish.
Rabbi Adlerstein, I'm going to cut in here and just take up your point, and I'm going to throw it over to Rabbi Farber. There's a quote by Rav Lichtenstein, which goes as follows. He says, "How much hatred, animosity, and demonization comes through in this awful and terrible ruling? The conversion authority has God-fearing and scholarly judges who have devoted their energy and their lives to the Torah. One cannot simply push them aside and throw them into the street. On this point, we must be firm. We must not come to terms with this kind of approach. Where do we ever hear or see that someone who relies on a minority opinion against the commonly held one is considered a willing heretic? Woe to the ears that hear such a thing, and woe to the biased court that has expressed itself in such a way." We all have stories, I guess, about Batei Dinim that may not follow the proper standard, Rabbi Adlerstein, on both sides of the coin, not just the ones that you're referring to. But I'm wondering, Rabbi Farber, since you're the one who used the word political before, whether you think that, in fact, this has been a kind of hijacking in some way, and how you view Rav Lichtenstein's quote. I'll repeat the question. Did you hear the quote by Rabbi Lichtenstein? No. Okay, so I'm going to repeat it. When the decision by Rabbi Sherman went down, Rabbi Lichtenstein said the following: "How much hatred, animosity, and demonization comes through in this awful and terrible ruling. The conversion authority has God-fearing and scholarly judges who have devoted their energy and lives to Torah. One cannot simply push them aside and throw them into the street. On this point, we must be firm. We must not come to terms with this kind of approach. Woe to the ears that hear such a thing, and woe to the biased court that has expressed itself in such a way." Would you say that you're in consonance with that view?
Yes, I would say 100% in consonance with Rabbi Lichtenstein's opinion. Let me comment on two things. Rabbi Adlerstein accused me of being comfortable with using the civil courts or the Supreme Court in this case to validate, so to speak, conversions done through the conversion authority. Since I'm a strong believer that the opinions expressed by Rabbi Sherman in the Psak essentially reflect a radical minority view, I think it's important to say that using Rabbi Adlerstein's terms, I have a responsibility to reject that in any using any methods that I may. Going beyond that, this is a country where there is a fascinating interface between law and halakha. It's not a theocracy, especially when it comes to marriage. And as such, if I believe, which I do, and I believe that there's strong halakhic basis to believe so, that these conversions are valid and these people are Jews, then number one, I feel, or I believe, that endangering individuals who have gone through these conversions or preventing them from getting married is essentially a violation, a doraita, an isur, a lotonu etager. And how can I stand back and let radical elements within the ultra-Orthodox world that I do not subscribe to simply manipulate the law in a way that I consider to be problematic both on halachic and moral grounds? As such, I'm going to use the tools that are at my disposal. Am I comfortable about this? No. Do I know that the radical right of the ultra-Orthodox community dismisses me and my vision or version of Jewish life? Yes, I'm aware of that. Do I respect them for their Torah? Absolutely. Do I believe that their conversions are valid? Depends. Some of them have engaged in equally problematic behavior, corruption, Lashon Hara, for example, that might also invalidate them as Dayanim. But I respect them and their willingness to try to live within their halakhic universe. But I think it's time it be said that unfortunately, and as tragic as this is, the halakhic universe that is represented by Rabbi Sherman, notwithstanding his history and his resume, the halakhic universe that he operates in is not the halakhic universe that's part of my animamim and the animamim of the gedolim that I find myself under their purview. So the bottom line is I'm not comfortable with this, but we need to speak out for those who cannot speak out for themselves.
Rabbi Freundel, I wanted to ask you to comment on that, and also if you could at the end of that, if you could speak about the implications of this for the RCA deal. In other words, do you feel uneasy at any point now dealing with Israeli rabbis and Israeli courts as a result of this?
Rabbi Adlerstein said it was very sharp and very cute, but I didn't suggest that every halachic opinion that might be a minority opinion is usable, number one. Number two, there's a vast difference between the Pelegish situation and this. The use of a minority opinion in a Shas HaTzach means there has to be a Shas HaTzach. I'm not quite sure what the Shas HaTzach would be to get the Pelegish in. But the Shas HaTzach here is that you have a state in Israel that has a very mixed population coming from all over. There's a huge crisis of Russians coming who are Jewish or not Jewish, maybe Jewish, don't have documentation, may have been converted, may not have been converted. It creates huge social strain on the community. There's a real danger that that other groups may grab them and do other things with them, ranging from Christian missionaries to non-halachic conversions. That's a Shas HaTzach. In Shas HaTzach, you are allowed to go back to minority opinions. That's the halacha. And the question of who determines when a position has fallen out of use is also a very interesting one. So first of all, I think that the parallel is a false parallel on many, many levels. Second of all, I think you have to recognize that within the issue of gayrus, there are situations in which leniency is allowed. Let me give you a specific one. Since you talked about Pelegish, we'll talk about something related. Eishes Yifas Toa. The conversion of an Eishes Yifas Toa, of a woman who's captured in war, is specifically not to the same standards of Kabbalah and Mitzvah because of what she's going through, the difficulty that she's going through. There are places in Halakha where this is allowed. I'm not suggesting step out of Halakha, and I'm not suggesting that every opinion is acceptable. I am saying that you have to recognize the pressures that are there. But I'm saying something more, and I think you made my case more eloquently than I did. There is a vast difference between looking at an individual conversion and saying we have a problem. There's a vast difference between reluctantly and with great pain saying about a Dayan, he's functioned in a way that's totally inappropriate, therefore we have to invalidate essentially what he's done, and going, as we generally do, quietly, case by case, and looking. And if, in fact, the numbers that I've seen, the small amount of, small percentage of the cases that were done on the Shas HaTchak kind of things, where there's some leniency that was allowed. Even what you said about the case in Ashdod, it's not what I heard about the case in Ashdod. Were these people fully Shomer Shabbat? No. Were they at least keeping some part of Shabbat? Yes. Did they have some understanding about Shabbat? That's not clear to me. And I'm not passing on this case, because this is all, you know, a lot of stuff flowing around. But I think those things have to be looked at and looked at carefully. That's vastly different. Than putting this out in public, and I think you have to understand that. Also, I have a question for you, Rabbi Adelstein. 40 years ago in America, when there was no Orthodoxy to speak of, when you had Rabbanim, who was serious Rabbanim and serious Talmidei Chachamim, and were faced with a situation with intermarriage after intermarriage, where they could get any kind of a conversion in, maybe in that way keep the kids Jewish in some way, do you really fault them? Do you really say that those conversions should be undone? They weren't doing this because, in the way you portrayed them, they knew it wasn't Halacha, they left it for the next generation or the generation after. They were doing it because they had their fingers in dikes that were springing leaks all over the place, and they were in danger of drowning, and they were trying to do anything they could to fix it. That's a Shas HaTchak again. Does that mean all those conversions are not good? I certainly wouldn't subscribe to such a position. This is sort of, you know, Al Kodinus Chaverchad Shetagiyo L'mkomo. Those guys were in situations where they had absolutely no hope. We have the luxury of a much stronger Torah community, and therefore the luxury of much higher standards. But I don't blame Rabbanim as 30, 40 years ago, and there are statements that have been quoted in the GPS from the Rav, from Rav Moshe, which allowed all kinds of lenient positions in Gerush. Then, not now, it's a different world, it's a different universe, and I think that has to be taken into account too. As Israel is a different place than here, as the Sionite part of Israel is different than the Haredi part, there has to be some leeway. And even the way you described the Hillel and Shammai thing, they were not communities who delegitimized themselves. They may have kept away from individual person here and individual person there, but that was done quietly. That's a very different thing that we're talking about here. And whatever the fault of whatever Dayanim are doing things wrong and have done things wrong, I think there is an equal fault in people who are dealing with this, accept the whole halachic integrity of doing it in a way that gets it out public and creates this kind of agmas nefesh for people. I think that's terrible. I think that's an abla, and I think they have to answer for that kind of thing. There are ways to respond to a halachic problem where you don't blow it up and make it this kind of thing, and I think that's crucial. Now, in terms of the RCA, of course I'm concerned. I'm concerned from the beginning. The fact of the matter is, you know, we had a sudden announcement that you know, RCA conversions, American conversions, are not acceptable. We spent almost 2 years getting to a point where we now have an agreement where there's a structure and a system that is acceptable. But who knows? And again, Rabbi Adelstein said, no, they won't do it on those kind of grounds. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that tomorrow there won't be an issue. And I'm not so sure that they won't go after practices that somebody thinks are halachic, but other people don't think are halachic. And, you know, you can substantiate those positions as halachic, but nonetheless, you know, we're not comfortable with that kind of thing. This is a very tenuous time. And from some quarters, my sense is, people live to tussle, live to say, oh, I got this one, or I got this guy, and I got this group of comrades. That's a very bad thing. There isn't the counterweight. There isn't that sense that you're walking in areas where you have to tread very carefully, because, you know, causing pain for a ger is a very serious violation, and that if you have to do anything, you have to do it reluctantly, you have to do it quietly, you have to do it where you talk to the person and talk about ways to fix it, rather than what we have here is, you know, people have scalps on their belt for all the things that they've managed to accomplish and all the people they've managed to tussle.
I'm going to actually throw it open from some of the questions that I've been receiving from our listeners, who I definitely want a say. One of the questions here is, I guess I'll pose to you, Rabbi Farber, is the question of what might be called church-state separation. In other words, do you see Israel moving in a direction where, say, civil marriage might be possible, where all of this distrust and suspicion that may have been built up towards rabbinical courts, especially on the part of the secular Israeli public, will have the ramification, perhaps, of leading to greater separation of rabbinic power and perhaps other options for marriage within Israel. Okay, you didn't hear that question. So I'm going to type it for you.
Seth, can you hear me?
If I understood correctly, you were exploring the notion of civil marriage as an option, and I think this is where it's headed. Is that correct? Okay, let me try to address that question, at least in some way. Church-state relations here are very complicated. They're essentially determined by political decisions. Again, I return to Rabbi Adlerstein's comment. If we want the state to have any role in determining a personal status issue, which right now it has a pretty central role, then that's not going to be decided by rabbis, at least not exclusively by rabbis. It's going to be decided by political considerations in the Knesset. Last night, someone commented to me that it's quite ironic that the real danger of the Rabbanut disappearing didn't in the end emerge from the Aguna issue and, to a certain extent, the inability of the Rabbanut to provide creative solutions for Aguna, but instead from the Giur issue, the personal status issue of those who really found themselves outside the community, not those inside the community. There's no question that there is serious discussion among Orthodox rabbinical leadership whether the Rabbanut right now is doing a greater good to Jewish people in Israel. I personally believe there is a role for the state in Jewish life in Israel. And as such, it would be tragic for the Rabbanut to simply become the province of the ultra-Orthodox and exclusively the ultra-Orthodox on these matters. Has there been significant damage done? Unquestionably. Have people who were on their way to convert stopped converting? Definitely. Have people stopped getting married through the Rabbanut because of this issue? Absolutely. I can give numbers of cases of Orthodox people who are choosing now to get married in Cyprus rather than getting married through the Rabbanut simply to demonstrate their protest to the way the Rabbanut is treating individuals. But again, it's important to emphasize that the Rabbanut has a chance. There is no one Rabbanut, but there are representatives of that Rabbanut, and those representatives have a responsibility, both halachic in my estimation, although really I find myself, as you may have noticed, not to analyze in the halachic material here, I find myself not qualified to do that, but morally, I feel the rabbinic leadership has a responsibility to step up and say, this is inappropriate, this cannot go on, and as people committed to Klal Yisrael, we need to come up with creative solutions and not simply dismiss those who don't look or act exactly like we do.
I want to direct a question that came from the audience that I'm going to add to Rabbi Adlerstein. We know that there are opinions throughout Jewish history, and certainly in the 19th century specifically, in which there is an adaptation to new social standards, to the idea of what it means to do something l'shem shemayim, especially in Geirut. I'm thinking specifically of Tshuvot from Rav Shlomo Kluger and others, in which people are coming specifically not for the purposes of doing of mekabel ol mitzvot, but rather to get married. And he has stated specifically that such a thing could be reinterpreted as L'shem Shemayim in modernity because people have options to get married elsewhere. I'm wondering how you feel on a kind of meta-halachic level, philosophically, about the notion that perhaps after the Enlightenment, we have to rethink the very notion of what it means to expect Geirim to be marrying only for the purest of intentions, when in fact there's an enormous sociological crisis of intermarriage and assimilation that has been going on for 200 years, and whether the halakha categories can be reinterpreted in a certain sense the way Rav Kluger is suggesting, such that to say that these are the standards and only the standards that we should accept might require rethinking.
I would not use the same terminology, Eliot. I don't think Shlomo Kluger was responsible for a revolution in halachic thought. Shlomo Kluger and other matirim in the 19th century simply used well-established understandings of the Gemara and Rishonim and applied it to changing circumstances, which is what halacha is all about. I know very few batei din around that refuse the conversion application of someone who's either married or affianced to someone Jewish. We may check a little bit more carefully for the sincerity and to make sure that it's not just wishes of parents or some other external factor. But the bottom line halachically is that when the Gemara said that you are bodek, you check a person's intention, what you're trying to see is sincerity and their ability to lead a life of mitzvot. None of that really has anything to say about the alleged instances in the hundreds of people who were converted despite the almost impossibility of them changing in any meaningful way. The case that I read in Ashdod was different from the description of Rabbi Freundel. The only difference in Shmirat Shabbat was that they lit Shabbos candles, but there was no halachic Shabbos other than a ceremonial. But that's a quibble. That's a small point. I think people are making far too much out of people reading new understandings of halacha. Quite to the contrary, halacha is dynamic. Halacha is flexible. That doesn't mean that you can bend it over 360 degrees three times and twist it into a pretzel. There are limitations of it. I don't agree with Rabbi Freundel. Rav Yaakov Emden's Tzak on Pilegesh would not be accepted even in a Shat HaChak, even if you could imagine such a thing. There are deot that are simply dismissed from halacha. I would have to take issue with Rabbi Farber as well. The thinking about the alleged cases. Again, I'm not in a position where I can know the veracity of them, but the allegations are such that the vast majority of halachic thinkers, such a great majority, and when I asked of Herschel Schechter 2 weeks ago if he could name anyone on the same side as Rav Uziel, he and Rav Gedalia Schwartz could not think of a single posek in the same camp. I don't think for all that we must find a way of dealing with some very, very serious problems of the state that we can ever bear to pay the price of sacrificing halacha. And that either is what's happened or what has alleged to be happened, what's alleged to have happened, and I still have to hear from anyone out there a point-by-point refutation of Rav Sherman. That would seem to me to be the best way out of the initial crisis. Show us that he's wrong. Show everyone out there that he's wrong. Instead of talking about politics, which may or may not be true, and even if it is true, it's going to be irrelevant for the lives of thousands of gayrim who now have to worry about the substantive issues that were raised. Why aren't people writing tshuvot? Send me a tshuva by Rav Dov Lior or by Rav Yaakov Ariel, and I'll jump to your side.
Can I comment in response?
Yes.
Misunderstood. I'm not suggesting that every halachic position that ever existed is acceptable. I don't agree with that. I think that's a form of epistemology that clearly is not halachic. I responded, specifically with the Pilegesh, because you had raised it. There was no discussion about Pilegesh. As I said, it was a very cute response. And I don't think there's anybody who accepts Pilegesh today, and I agree with you. But Geirus has always been an area in which there have been categories that have been less than optimal. And those categories are applied to Shas Adchak. For example, some of the issues with the various communities that have come to Israel, the Ethiopians, the Indians, the other communities that have come, because precisely that was really a shasat chak. And you do have in halacha, I mentioned the issue of eshet shifas tor, you have gerim grurim, you have somebody who's nizgayer bein akum. Now, what the applicability today is of those categories is an interesting question, but the truth of the matter is they exist, they were there, but the gerim of the time of David and Shlomo, you just have a whole series of categories that are less than optimum gerim, that were used under certain circumstances, under certain difficulty. There is room in the halacha, it seems to be, for that. Now, in terms of responding with a tshuva, yeah, I think the point-by-point questions are there. I'm not trying to say to you that every one of Rav Drukman's conversions is okay or not okay. I don't know. I haven't investigated them. But I think we've avoided the point again and again. There are ways to deal with a halachic problem or a series of halachic problems if they exist in this area that doesn't require public attack or public delegitimization in the way that it was done. Unless you really feel you've got somebody who's so totally unethical that everything they've ever done is no good, and you're going to, you know, take it back as far as we go. I think that that's where the Avla is. The point-by-point refutation involves investigation, it involves the question of who these people are. It may well be, let's leave Rav Drukman out of it, it may well be that in a particular circumstance, as you go through the gay room, there's some that are good, there's some that are not good, and maybe you have to decide that they're all not good. But I think the point that you're missing, again and again, is that whatever was done wrong by person X or Bezdin X, the reaction of the halachic community, of people who want legitimate gayers, has to be done carefully, because you can't just, with this broad brush, do this kind of thing without creating huge consequences. The responsibility lies there for that action, even if there may have been antecedent actions that were less than perfect, and therefore may require that a particular gayrus is not good, or a particular gayrus requires a gayrus l'chumra, or another gear, or whatever else that you do to try to fix it. But I don't think you do it this way, and that's the point that I think has been lost here.
I'm wondering.
I don't think it's been lost on me, Rabbi Freindel. I concur with that fully. I can't understand why such a momentous decision was made with such broad strokes. I'm not comfortable with it. I'm not going to judge Rav Sherman. I don't know the frustrations that he's dealt with over 10 years, but I agree that is not the way halacha should be done. I don't disagree in the slightest.
I just wanted to ask each of you if you're aware of what were the actual circumstances behind communication with Rav Drukman. In other words, was he ever confronted with these issues and told, you know, if you continue on this path, this is what's going to happen? Was it done suddenly, behind his back? I'm just trying to get clarity, and some of our listeners are too, if anybody has the facts on this matter.
I mean, I'll respond. I had a long conversation with someone
in the
system in Israel. I can't specify who, but someone who should be in a position to know, so I'm going to believe that. That is not what happened.
Yeah,
this was the appeal of the case from Ashdod.
Summoned to a hearing.
And in Ashdod, what I was told, truth or not,
by Rabbi Sherman and the bench
woman
that he represented.
Outside of court conversation, one of the
Dayans
mentioned some things that it raised some questions for this Dayan. This Dayan, you know, as opposed to what is the normal protocol,
went ahead and wrote a
Shiloh to himself, not to the Bezdin, didn't convene the Bezdin Ashdod, went into his study, wrote the tshuva, the first tshuva, which delegitimatized Rav Drukman, which said all kinds of nasty things about him, delegitimatized all his conversions, even delegitimatized the Jewish husband of this woman, who was a natural-born Jewish Israeli, and raised questions about whether he could ever get married. And he didn't publicize this. He put it into her file. And she was waiting to get an issue. She was waiting to get a letter saying that she was, in fact, divorced. She kept calling. They put her off. And what I was told was she eventually came across a clerk who didn't know the politics of what was going on. I hesitate to use the word politics, but in this case, didn't know what the implications were. And that clerk photostatted the tick and sent it to her. And that's how this thing got out public then. And nothing was done. Then it was taken on appeal to Rav Sherman's Bezdin. But I don't believe that there was communication, at least not in the way I heard the story, where somebody sat down with Rav Drukman. Obviously, that's the first thing you've got to do in a situation like that. We don't live in an era where that kind of thing goes on, unfortunately, where people sit down, try to work it out. We're looking, you know, as I said before, people hang scalps on their belt with how many people they tussle. That's part of what troubles me so much about this. Without particular defense of Rav Drukman or a particular conversion or anybody else for that matter. I'm not saying anything, I'm saying no. But that's part of the problem, as I understand it.
Rabbi Farber, would you care to respond?
Yeah. In the Supreme Court brief that will be made public next week, the documentation chain and the protocols, the phone conversations and letters that were written between the Rabbi Amar, the president of the Supreme Rabbinical Court, and Rabbi Sherman will be made public. It's very clear, and this emerged also in the Knesset meetings that took place last week on this issue, that there was serious disciplinary violation on behalf of, or by Rabbi Sherman. One of the readers just wrote that he understood that Rabbi Sherman was asked specifically not to publish the psak. Not only that, but there were other disciplinary violations in this particular case. This simply highlights the fact that there were other considerations, not just what I would love to believe would be pure halakha, that were playing a role here in the formulation and in the execution, and I use that word very carefully, of this psak din. Let me say that unfortunately the rabbinate has become a place, particularly for immigrants from the former Soviet Union, of mutual suspicion and distrust. As much as the rabbis don't trust and even suspect the immigrants from the FSU, the immigrants from the FSU feel the rabbinate is no longer a place that they can see as a place to support their Jewish needs. And this is a tragedy. These, let me remind you, are the people that we stood on the mall for, screaming Free Soviet Jewry Now, probably all five of us and all the people listening. These are the people who we believe were part and parcel of Kol Yisrael. And some of them who need conversion or who seek conversion would not be simply dismissed as other. So there were serious disciplinary violations. Rabbi Druckmann was invited by the court, by the Supreme Court, the Rabbinical Court, the Beit HaDin HaGadol, to a hearing. He wrote a letter in response saying that he felt it was outside of their jurisdiction. They didn't respond and simply never spoke to him, despite Rabbi Amar's appearance. Again, I wasn't there, but that's what the brief says, and that's what the documentation seems to support, despite Rabbi Amar's insistence that this psak din not move forward.
Okay, we're really going to wrap it up on the East Coast here. It's 11 o'clock. I know it's morning in Israel and still early evening in LA. I guess I just want to ask one last thing and have everybody respond to it. I think everybody, all our listeners and many we speak to are trying to understand if the issue that's come up with the Gayrud controversy is an isolated issue. In other words, it has to do specifically with Rav Druckmann's Beit Din, or whether it's the thin edge of the wedge. In other words, if there's a parallel between the conversion crisis and, say, what occurs with Heter Mechira every time there's a Shemitah year, and whether there's just a notion of imposing standards on the general population that are out of sync with them. So I guess I'm wondering, do you see what's occurred here in Gayrud as an isolated phenomenon that has to do with a specific Beit Din, or do you see it as really reflective or symbolic of a much greater religious crisis that's going on in Israel and perhaps to some extent in the diaspora as well? We'll begin with Rabbi Adlerstein.
The point is well taken. I certainly think it's part of something bigger. I think it's a conflict and a tension between two different halachic visions. There is one community that believes that the halachic process that kept us alive in Galut for 2,000 years, that we refused under any circumstances to compromise on, is being compromised because of some vision of a state to be built. And people are saying that we didn't give in for any other purpose and we're not going to give in on halakha for these circumstances either. The other side is saying that what these people are doing is turning Torah into a fossil, that we can't allow the Torah that we lived by for 2,000 years of Galut to run the risk of being desecrated by not having its brilliance shine through and show that it's capable of building the state that HaKadosh Baruch Hu finally gave us after 2,000 years. The irony of it is that both of them, despite the fact that they rarely speak to each other, are really standing up for the Kavod HaTorah, only coming at it from different angles and maybe emphasizing different parts of it. If I can be bold enough to end on an optimistic note, I don't have a solution to the Gayrut controversy. I think there's a lot more to be said, but I think the reaction after the massacre of the Eight Kedoshim at Merkaz HaRav showed a lot of people that when people think that Torah itself is threatened, that we all intuitively recognize that despite all the differences, that in fact is what binds us together. I wish it were something that could be bottled and used in times of lesser crisis and applied to situations like this.
Rabbi Freundel?
It would be very hard to suggest that this isn't part of a larger issue and a larger agenda. And it goes back to, you know, something that I suggested before. When the sort of Tzioni Dati, the sort of religious Zionists, were in charge of the Rabbanut HaRashit, the Haredi, but they didn't function. They, you know, they were tolerated in essence. You do your way, that'll be fine. Now that the power of that position has been taken over by people who come from a more Haredi position, there is less tolerance for the, if you will, religious Zionists to do their way. I don't see them as in quite the same way Rabbi Adlerstein does. I think they're very serious halachic people, and I don't think they're just saying, oh, halacha is fasalas. Are they willing to be more makil? Are they willing to find more makil positions in the halacha and use them on occasion? Yeah, but many of these people are not simply saying, oh, we have to change it because of the times, we have to do that, and they recognize that there are limits and there are clearly shittos that we don't accept, and there's certainly opinions that may have existed at one time that aren't relevant today and aren't real today, and they're interesting for historical reasons. I think it's really a question of how much you allow the realities of the state to allow you to move to what are acceptable, lenient positions in halakha, and how much you have this purist attitude and don't care what the implication for the state is. That's the way I would have phrased it. But there's no question that this is part of a huge ideological struggle that colors many, many, many things, both in the state and in the United States. And it's really unfortunate because there is, and I go back to that model, there's no Hillel and Shammai. We'll tolerate what you do in your community or with your individual cases, and you tolerate what we do in our individual cases. And, you know, we'll keep certain things separate, but we'll go along recognizing that we have two communities that are halachically committed, working, you know, for the best, for Torah, Mitzvot, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We've lost that capacity at all. Anybody who's not me is just no good, and I think that's a real problem.
Rabbi Farber, we're going to give you the last word, and I guess I'm wondering, based on the previous question, whether you think there's a kind of inevitable split in orthodoxy that is occurring.
I'd like to believe that it doesn't have to happen this way. I don't adopt the position that we need to rely on kulas relating to giur as much as we need to rely on chumras relating to Klal Yisrael. And within Klal Yisrael, I include not just the non-observant population, but the population that calls itself ultra-Orthodox as well. And I want to believe that somehow we can find a modus operandi that at least we can respect each other enough, especially within the Orthodox community, to recognize there are different halachic standards and there are different halachic perspectives. I don't think any seasoned and reasoned Orthodox Jew really believes at this point that halacha has not, to a certain extent, readapted to modernity, and the halacha and the standards that we have today are no longer the standards that we had 2,000 years ago, and that's a good thing. It doesn't mean it's not me, Allah Moshe mi Sinai. But if our debate is going to depend on whether Avraham Avinu put on tefillin or didn't put on tefillin, then we probably don't have that much to talk about, notwithstanding the fact that many Rishonim say explicitly that he put on tefillin. But if that's the halachic debate today, then I'm not sure we have much more room to find a common ground. But I'd like to believe we do have room to find a common ground, and that those Rishonim didn't relate to a historical reality as much to some other level of reality. And as such, if we're looking for common ground, I think it's still possible. I don't think we need to split. I don't think we need to create a fourth or fifth or sixth denomination here. We have someplace to land in between. But for us to do that, we have to recognize that the newfound power of Orthodoxy has to manifest itself in an embracing culture, in a culture of inclusion and not a culture of exclusion. Power can allow a person to, or an individual or a community, to isolate itself. Or it can say, we have greater responsibilities for those who are like us and even those who aren't necessarily like us. And if we can find a way to harness that power, the power of orthodoxy, then I think we have a much greater chance of finding a common ground. I want to take this opportunity to wish all of you at Torah in Motion Yashar Koach on this opportunity to speak across the globe, and wish you all a Chodesh Tov. I think we have to run to shul right now.
Thank you very much. I want to thank all of our speakers, Rabbi Adlerstein, Rabbi Freundel, Rabbi Farber, for a wonderful discussion. And I'm going to wish you a Yom Tov, a Chodesh Tov, and also Chag Sameach upcoming. I'll turn it over to Rabbi Kelman.
I want to thank Elliot. I want to reinforce the thanking the speakers for a fascinating panel. I want to thank Elliot for doing a wonderful job, as he always does, like moderating our Torah in Motion events. You can hear his moderation of many, many panels, and I use that word as the pun intended, many, many panels that we have on our MP3 site. It's a pleasure having everybody. We want to thank all the listeners, and we hope to learn with you online, live, email, et cetera, and we look forward to doing more of these types of programs in addition to our regular evening classes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you to our tech team, who put this all together. Without their wonderful help, David Callender and Shalom Eisenstadt, for their wonderful work in putting it all together and making it all possible. And Chag Sameach, and let's hope for the unity of Klal Yisrael, the birthday of David HaMelech, the great-granddaughter of Ruth HaMoaviyah, and we should all be able to dance together in Kabbalah Satzora as one people despite our many differences. Good night to everybody. Thank you very much.